What up, what up? Welcome to Mind Your Hive's Beekeeping. I am your host, Greg Lehman. I'm here with my beautiful co-host and my wife, Kara Jo.
Hello, hello.
If you're new to the podcast, welcome, welcome. I'd like to give a little intro. We're a beekeeping podcast, but we're going to talk about more than just beekeeping. We're going to crack a beer. Speaking of beer,
I'm excited for the one we're having.
Yeah, today. We're going to crack this really rad beer called Wittgenstein from the Refrend Beer Blendery in Kutztown, Pennsylvania. Really, really cool. It's a spontaneously fermented ale. It's got citrus, it's got chamomile. You want to pour this, Kara?
Yeah, I do. We were just there the other day, and
shout out James.
Drink this one?
We did. They had it on tap. Shout out James and Melissa, and congrats. They just had a baby. They just drove to Florida this week, so I'm curious to see how they're doing. How that hell little road trip with like a two-month-old went. But yeah, we like to go off on little tangents. If you just purely want a beekeeping podcast that's just, you know, somebody just talking about bees only and doing their thing, that's fine. We're going to just have a little bit more personality in here. So I hope you're here for it, and I hope you enjoy it. And thank you so much for all the feedback. I think since we started doing this little intro, people have been hitting us up like, thank you so much. A lot of these podcasts are just really boring, and just it's nice to have like a little bit of extra going on. Yeah. And then of course we've had a few reviews that are like, these people have fun. Don't listen to it.
When we listen to beekeeping podcasts in the car when we go on trips, I'm like, turn this off.
Dude, I was driving home from work the other night. I wasn't even tired. And I was driving home at like, I don't know, 7 at night. I mean, it wasn't even late. I literally was listening to a podcast and I was like, I think I'm going to fall asleep. I had to turn it off while I was driving. And I wanted the information.
Right,
like,
yeah.
The reason I clicked on it was because I was like, ooh, this is really good. I would love to hear somebody else's perspective about, I think it was actually Swarms, but I couldn't do it.
Yeah.
Ugh. It's just annoying.
So boring. Whatever. So monotone. By the way, this beer is delightful.
Yeah, it's a wit beer, but they do a spontaneous firm, cool chip style.
You can taste the chamomile, and it's not too much.
All right, so this episode, we're going to talk about swarm control.
Okay.
Tis the season. It is March
10th?
10th-ish, Sunday, March 10th. So we're going to talk about swarm control. We're going to do a little bit of follow-up last episode.
We did talk about pollen last time.
Yeah, we ripped into people that do put pollen in there over winter with their bees in northern climates.
Or people that tell people to do it versus like making the mistake like, oops.
Yeah, you can't rip somebody that doesn't, you know, that just is going off of bad information.
Right.
I mean, we talked about the last episode. We talked about how to determine if a teacher's good, and it's if they're teaching you why and not just what. Which is funny because we talked about like, oh, I can't believe people are feeding pollen over winter, and we ripped it, but we didn't really say why.
Right.
It wasn't the point of the episode. It was just something that one of our kind of mentees told us about. Let's just get into it. Spring pollen.
Let's talk about that. Yeah.
All right. Not spring pollen so much, but yeah, we'll talk about spring pollen too.
Okay. Lead the way.
This episode and all episodes brought to you by Kara Jo's
Skincare and Bee Farm.
I always wait till the very end to mention our company.
Yeah, we should do it in the beginning.
Yeah, maybe beginning, middle.
Yeah.
Go online, KaraJoSkincare.com. We've got all these apiary and honey products.
And we're coming out with more products, man.
And by the way, when we say this all the time, but when we get an order and it's somebody that we've talked to or gone back and forth with or just seen, you know, via Instagram or something with Mind Your Hives.
It's so exciting.
It's so great. It makes us happy. All right. So it's funny. I was a bit of a hypocrite. Like I said, you know, don't do this, but I didn't say why not to do this. And this leads to this whole like ask 2 beekeepers, get 3 answers, or ask 3 beekeepers, get 5 answers. It's a cop out. It's a total cop out because guess what? Yeah. And people just go, oh no, you know, there's just so many different things you can do in beekeeping. Ask 2 beekeepers, get 3 answers. And I swear it's people's kind of like rationale for bad beekeeping information, right? Like don't ask 3 beekeepers what to do. Ask 3 beekeepers why.
Yeah, that's a good
to do something. And again, you'll get 3 different, you'll get 5 different, you get so many different answers, but you can learn something from it. And also, a lot of times when you go, oh, why?
People don't
They
know.
Got nothing. They go, yeah. Well, that's because that's what you do.
Yeah.
You go, nah, dog.
Right, because you had mentioned this and I was like, I don't know. I think part of ask whatever and get so many answers, whatever it is people are doing things in different locations. So you do things differently in different locations.
Yeah, it's not black and white.
Right. So you could ask somebody in Vermont and they will give you a different answer than someone in Georgia versus someone like in California versus someone in
Pennsylvania.
Yeah, versus someone in Australia or whatever.
So by the way, we're in southeastern Pennsylvania. We're, you know, northern climate. When we're talking about pollen feeding, this is completely different than down south.
Absolutely.
We're going to talk about winter bees and winter bee genetics. That's not even something I don't think you really even see down south. Our bees in these northern regions literally change their genetics over winter. And the studies that I've read to just, you know, support what we're going to talk about, they were all like, these are based on northern bees.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, just right there, no, and I say this every single episode, no, who is telling you something where they're keeping bees? But if they're telling you why, you can kind of learn a little bit more and determine what makes sense for you. And that involves where they are, right? Like,
which makes sense because we've talked about this before, but it's like easy to fall into the trap of like having somebody be like, this is what I do. And you're like, oh, that sounds good. I'll do that. But
it actually drives me nuts when somebody's just like, what do I do? And I say it and they're like, great. And I'm like, ah, no. Like,
well,
and does it make sense? Does this add up for you?
Which is what comes in the why. Okay. Yeah. What are you doing? All right. Why do you do that? I think that's good advice.
I mean, when I managed a lot of people, I managed some sales teams in my past. It was whenever one of my team, whatever you call it, one of my people. one of my peeps, whenever they would say, hey, what do I do? I'd go, what do you think we should do? And then I'd literally go, why is that? And I even in the interview process would say, like, I'm the type of manager, I want you to ask me questions when you don't know something. And if I ask you a question, you don't know it, I don't want you to make something up. Just say you don't know it. And we'll figure it out together. But if you're coming to me just saying, what do I do? That's going to piss me off.
Right.
You say, have to have like this is what I think we should do. Yeah. And this is why I think we should do it. Do you agree? And let's have a conversation. But just don't. It drives me nuts.
Well, that comes into like the whole decision making with beekeeping.
Decision making just, yeah, period.
But, right. But when you come into beekeeping, so I was talking to someone I work with and she was trying to figure out, does she has not been successful in beekeeping. And she was like, I don't know, Kara, what do you think? Do you think I beekeep next year? Because she was going to buy bees from us. And then she was like, not going to buy bees from us. And I was like, what's going on? And she was going through the whole thing. And basically, she doesn't know how to make decisions.
Well, and we know who her teacher was when she was a beginner. And we know that teacher doesn't teach any why at all.
Well, and so her husband, I guess apparently her husband like makes decisions all day long. Like that's his job. He is like the leader of the group and he's like making all these decisions. So when it comes to the weekends and beekeeping, he's like, I don't feel like doing.
He's got to turn it off.
Yeah. He's like, you make the decision. She's like, I just don't know what decisions to
make.
He
just poops in his pants and he doesn't eat unless somebody's feeding him. It's pretty nuts. Oh, God.
And so I was just sitting there listening to her and finally I'm like, I think you should just like not beekeep. It seems stressful to you. She was like, but I like being in with the bees and that. But like, then afterwards, I don't know what to do. And I just don't feel confident. And
it's not for everybody.
That's what I said.
And it's certainly not for people that don't want to make decisions.
And then I told her, you know, maybe you could support the native bee wildlife, which we should do an episode on that sometime. But yeah, it's really about, you need to sit down and you need to understand what decisions you have. And you also need to be able to make decisions on the fly in that moment. You need to make a decision.
An
educated decision based upon all of these factors and understand it and be able to weigh it out. And so I think that that's like maybe something that's overlooked or that's an important part.
The whole like ask two beekeepers, whatever, that annoys me so much. It's definitely a pet peeve when I hear it. And God, you hear it every single time you're at any like class or meeting. Somebody's going to say it. It also reminds me of my second biggest pet peeve phrase. The customer is always right. I hate the customer is always right. And you guys ready for this? That's not the full quote.
Oh, really?
The full quote is, the customer is always right in matters of personal taste.
Huh.
What a huge difference.
Which is true.
Exactly. I can't tell somebody they're tasting something differently. Like, nope, you're not tasting that. Like, that's personal taste. But the customer is always right without that end part is a total 180 from what the full quote is.
Especially nowadays. Absolutely not.
Who took off the ending of that quote and just let Karens run wild?
Yeah, right?
It's insane. So, yeah. I just thought that was great. Well, and what's funny is I'm sure it was TikTok. We don't have TikTok, but it leaks into like Instagram and other social media. But somebody said that recently. They were like, do you guys know the full Customers Always Right quote? And it was like, oh my God, this is amazing. I hope this spreads like wildfire.
Here we go. We're spreading it. But also just this whole ask two beekeepers, get three answers. I hear that in herbalism too. And
a lot of misinformation and dumb people spreading BS.
Yeah, that's what I'm wondering. Like, if you're really, and I come from like a lineage of herbalism teachers that's very fact-based and reads research, and that's where they're making their decisions and base off of, and they're constantly up to date with the latest research. And it's like, okay, well, if that's the case, shouldn't we follow the science in that regard? I mean, yeah, it's a person-to-person basis, so you have to kind of do that. And experience is really important. But it shouldn't be so, like, fluid that, I don't know, you could be right and I could be right and he can be right and she can be right and, like, everybody can be right.
Yeah, everybody can also be wrong. All right, so that long whole little rant we just had leads to the whole thing where people were like, well, why not use pollen in winter?
Why, like, what are you talking about?
My mentor told me to use pollen in winter. This dummy I follow online tells me to use pollen in winter. Like, why not? And I'm like, well, all right, fine. Like, this is a pretty in-depth. There's a pretty in-depth answer to this. And it's very rooted in, to be a good beekeeper, you need to understand the biology of bees.
Yes.
And we've listened to a bunch of speakers, and I just, when you see the topic is biology of bees, we know, like, oh man, this is so rad, because you're getting to like the root of
the why,
of the decision making, though. Because if you can understand their biology, you can really make educated decisions. So we're in Pennsylvania. We're talking about northern bees here. In the winter, your northern bees are a genetically different bee than a summer bee. Yeah. Okay. Sometimes call them fat bees.
Because they have to live throughout the winter.
Yeah. Yes. And summertime, what bees are living like 45 days, give or take. In the winter, they need to live up to 6 months. So they're literally a genetically different bee.
And they also need to rear the new young in the early or late winter, early fall. So that's like a big part of their genetics too, which I'm guessing is going to come into this.
Yeah. Another question you guess is, why use pollen in winter at all? Like, just what, like, you know, I said, when people come and my old sales team would come and be like, what do I do here? You know, I'd always be like, why? You know, you ask why. So somebody's asking me, why can't I use pollen? Why do you want to use pollen? Mm. The only answer that really makes any sense at all is, because I messed up big time sending my bees into winter. Okay. I sent them into winter without bee bread, without their own pollen stores. And now I'm screwed. I'm seeing that they don't have pollen. I don't know what to do. So, like, right off the bat, and we talk, oh, winter prep, winter prep, winter prep. Everything you do, everything, when you're talking about how much honey you want to get, if you're talking about how many hives you want to have the next year, it all comes down to how well you prepped them. Your beekeeping season starts in like September for the following year. It doesn't start in March or April when you're cracking the lids for the first time. It's starting when you're prepping those bees to get into winter, and your season ends when you're extracting that honey, and maybe you're getting a fall batch, but, you know, end of August, September, that's when your season ends. And the new season then starts, because it's all about that prep. So literally going like, because I messed up, I didn't prep properly.
Also, I'm thinking, why wouldn't somebody have enough pollen? Are they going into those three bottom boxes? I mean, I guess it depends on what boxes you have. But
did they have a weak hive that they just juiced up with a bunch of bees, but they didn't give them proper resources? Did they make a late split and they didn't give them pollen? Do they have their apiary in a location that doesn't have ample
resources?
Do they send their bees out to pollination and their bees aren't getting a winter break properly, and then they're shuffling them back and they're taking them from this monoculture, and their bees need more nutrients? you know, pollen has all these amino acids in it, but you need different pollen sources to get the full spectrum of those amino acids for them to literally live.
And if you don't get all the whole spectrum of amino acids, you might as well have none.
It's like all or nothing. Exactly. Yeah. So, I mean, the answer is if you're trying to figure out why you need pollen, it's because you must have messed up, and that's fine. You can mess up, but try to learn from it. Right. My next question back to them would be, are you a commercial beekeeper?
Probably answer is no.
Probably not.
I don't think any commercial beekeepers are listening to this podcast.
This podcast isn't meant for commercial beekeepers. We talk about bees being livestock all the time, but also treating bees like livestock, like where we buy our meat is treated, that livestock is treated way differently than where, you know, Acme Food Stores gets all their meat.
Ew.
Right? They're both livestock.
Right.
But it does, that's another, like, bees are livestock. Like, okay, you're downplaying the relationship of the beekeeper and the bees by just being like, bees are livestock. No. It's like, that doesn't mean you treat them poorly. It still means you do the best thing for the bee.
Right.
Still do the best thing for that cattle. Whatever. Forage a proper diet. They're in a monoculture. I, you know, personally, I kind of hate the whole pollination service bees. I get that it's a thing, but also, I don't know, if you have a blueberry farm and you need to bring in bees for pollination, maybe a part of your business should be an apiary on site.
Like, I know, right?
And there's things, these monoculture, huge swaths of almonds and all that. And I understand almonds are a huge, huge export for the US and for Australia. But like, I don't know. I'm a hater. We buy our food from smaller farms. We get our meat from smaller farms. And a lot of these huge commercial operations that are doing all these, that need these pollination services, they're not for us to begin with.
Right.
But you can't deny that it's something that exists.
And something that probably, yeah. I mean, there would have to be a huge cultural shift for them to not exist.
Yeah. So, all right. So we get past some of my counter questions and go like, all right, do you understand, winter bee genetics, right? So I wish we remembered, and Karen and I joke about this all the time, we're so bad at like writing who we learned something from. But
I know, we need to start doing that.
Kind of recently, within the last year or so, we saw a presentation where they showed that artificial pollen feeding isn't even being fed to the brood. It's only being consumed for protein content by worker bees. And it's like, okay, why aren't they feeding it to their brood?
Yeah, it's interesting.
That tells you something right there, right? Because I'm sure people do it, but when people are feeding pollen, they're feeding artificial pollen. They're feeding pollen substitutes.
Yeah, I don't really know anybody that's collecting pollen. There's like, that seems like a huge undertaking.
To collect the pollen and then feed it back to them is really cutting pointless. Your nose off to spite your face. Like, it's like running on a treadmill. Silly. So, sitting in a rocking chair, gives you something to do, but it's not going to get you anywhere.
Yeah. Gives you more work, actually.
Yeah. So, before we have these conversations, like, I really do dive in and read all these studies, and I get a lot of anxiety talking and giving my opinion on things to, these thousands of people.
Hundreds of thousands of listeners.
Yeah. I think we're up to like 30,000. But anyway, I get anxiety. I like literally lose sleep. I wake up sometimes. I'm like, oh man, what did I say? And then I'll like go on my phone and start reading and be like, okay, good. Okay. It's backed up by stuff, science. Like, yes, I misspeak every now and again, but like the overall gist of what we're talking about, I try to make this very educated. This is not, and we talk about it all the time. We talk about things that we have experienced. We try not to really talk about things that we don't have direct experience with. Right. So we have fed pollen before.
Yeah.
And we'll get into that later.
Okay.
So I dove deep into reading these like,
Was it anxiety reading?
No, because I don't get anxiety before a discussion. Although, again, this was like, we talked smack on pollen feeding and then I wanted to
make back sure
it
up.
It might have been, but no, this is more like research style.
Smack talking.
And so many of these bee studies are coming from Europe and Asia. Like, it's kind of nuts. I hate to say it, but I don't put a lot of trust when I see USDA on something. Well, I really don't.
Yeah, so, because we are a capitalist society and everybody's bought.
Yeah, yeah. We can do a whole different podcast about that. We
could speak about that for hours.
So anyway, this really rad Italian study done in 2020. A lot of this information I'm talking about is coming from there. But This is, you have to understand, okay, what triggers things with pollen? Like, what does pollen, the presence of pollen, even do for a bee? So right off the bat, the way bees get triggered into becoming and genetically modifying themselves, so to speak, is a lack of pollen. So the lack of pollen triggers these bees to go, okay, it's time to make winter bees, right? So it's time to flip the switch and go from summer bee to winter bee. And that makes sense. The season starts coming to an end, pollen's being depleted. That lack of pollen is going to trigger their brains to literally make different molecules that in turn
lead to
how bees function as winter bees. Like, the actual genetic makeup changes.
Yeah, because they have a totally different role. They have a different purpose in living.
Yeah, so, and it's the lack of pollen, right? But even more than that, the pheromone that's exchanged isn't just a pheromone that's floating around in the air. They're not, you know, quote unquote, smelling this pheromone. That pheromone is actually transmitted through the mouth. I use the term mouth. It's not really mouth, but the mouth-to-mouth contact of bees passing pollen and passing forage to each other. They're transferring that pheromone back and forth, and that is where the pheromone's found. So when they don't have anything to transfer, that pheromone isn't present, then they're going lack of pollen. Brain starts literally creating different molecules, creating winter bee. Literally, the lack of spitting in each other's mouths is lacking. That pheromone doesn't get spread, and then whammy. So winter bees, genetically, when these molecules are being changed and different molecules are created, it allows them to be able to store these nutrients that they're getting from pollen, right? So these amino acids, these nutrients. And it allows them to store it in their fat bodies, right? And then they're able to literally regurgitate through secretions these different amino acids and nutrients to feed their brood, okay? In the summertime, they're feeding their brood entirely bee bread. They don't need to regurgitate anything. They have the bee bread that is made starting with pollen and then mixed and like fermented and blah, blah, blah in the hive. Literally in the wintertime, they're not going to rely on that. Now, again, make sure you send your bees into winter with bee bread.
Plenty of it.
But bee bread is different than pollen. Pollen, quote unquote, bridge that and then transfer it to another bee, have it get mixed, a little bit of beeswax, whatever the microbiome that's in their bodies that is allowing for a bit of fermentation and the fun processes that turn it into this bee bread.
Which is probably why it's called bee bread, because it is like this.
There's more to it.
Yeah.
Everything is fermentation. I love it, including this delightful beer
from Ruffer. It's so good. I'm really enjoying it.
It's so good. I get scared when I see chamomile in a beer because I just think, oh God, it's going to be overwhelming. This is so subtle and perfect. I've
never had that experience. I love chamomile.
Because I give you the right beers.
Yeah, you do. I'm lucky.
I'm a taste tester. So this literally, these bees are able to regurgitate through their own secretions, not just grabbing the bee bread and feeding it. So that's what's happening. When you're feeding pollen early, right, or you're feeding pollen in the winter, but especially open feeding in way too early in the springtime, that itself, and this is the study, can spell disaster and stress for a colony because there's still winter ahead. And we're in the perfect example of this right now. You know, we just had like 65, 70 degree days followed by 7 days of rain and cold.
Gnarly.
So say we would have towards the end of February going, oh my gosh, it's 60 degrees. Let's throw some pollen out so these bees can get all this pollen. We would have literally been triggering those bees to go, okay, there's pollen. They don't know that it's artificial versus regular when they're foraging it. Apparently they know once it gets in the hive because they don't feed it to their young. But they don't know. They just go, wait, it's getting foraged. And guess what? Now they're bringing it back, transferring it to each other's mouths, passing this pheromone, spreading this pheromone. And they go, oh, there's pollen out there. There's forage out there. We don't need to be winter bees anymore.
Yeah.
So in this crazy change that happens, the vitellogenin, which I'm just going to call VG, but vitellogenin,
Vitellogenin is such a fun word. Why won't you say it?
Because I feel like I say it wrong every time. But anyway, so the VG, which is like their life force, depletes. So that same thing that allows them to live for 6 months versus 45 days, when they're triggered to go, there's pollen out there, it's time to not be a winter bee anymore. Their actual lifespan is getting shortened almost immediately.
Also, Vitellogenin, which is probably my favorite thing about bees.
It rules. I mean, it's so nuts.
It's so fabulous. We do have a episode, like an old episode that talks about it. And I think I pronounce it wrong the entire episode. But Vitellogenin depletes as a bee. They like...
It's a literal life force. Lower Vitellogenin, lower amount of life left.
And so it depletes as the bee ages. But as the Vitellogenin changes and depletes, their roles change in the hive. So it's literally...
Foragers have the least amount of Vitellogenin. Yes. It's the last stage of their life.
And the queen has the most. She's like ramped up with it. But not only is it changing their life force, but it could be changing... you know, how they're operating.
So literally, you know, mid-February, you're like, oh, I'm going to be good. I'm going to feed these bees pollen. So you're shortening the lifespan of the bees in your hive right there. Because they're going, oh, there's forage. And then all of a sudden you hit 10 days of just terrible rain and cold. Now they can't go out and forage. But they've already gone, oh, wait, we need to change. Vitellogenin levels drop. It ain't coming back.
Right.
So you just... as a whole, shorten the lifespan of so many bees in your hive. Dude, we in Pennsylvania, we could get 30 inches of snow in March.
I know. Who knows?
Our bees for the entire month of March might not be able to forage.
Second winter is a thing.
You know, and we just put a little video out on Instagram, but like just make sure that there's winter feed. Make sure there's carbohydrates in that hive. So if they are getting stuck right now, they have the food because they're making brood, no doubt about it. But they're making brood at a natural pace unless you're artificially stimulating that brood. So much bad happens when you do that.
Well, are we going to talk about that? Or?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
All right. So as these bees are triggered to forage, so, you know, physiologically, they're losing that Vitellogenin and more bees are becoming foragers because they're saying there's forage available. It's leading to shorter lifespans. Great. It's also stimulating brood. Now, we talked about how artificial pollen is not being fed to brood for the most part. However, it is stimulating brood production. So all of a sudden, you got brood production being stimulated. They maybe don't have enough bee bread to support those brood. And maybe they don't have enough workers to raise the temperatures properly. So these bees they still in the wintertime are creating a very warm environment. But there's not much brood, if any, present in the winter. As brood gets present, they have to collectively raise the temperature inside these hives. And there's a ton of research that you can look up on lower temperature brood negatively affects bee development overall.
And so does lack of pollen.
Bing, bing, bing.
Yeah.
There's even more of that. So, all right. So the presence of brood also triggers these bees to lose Vitellogenin. So the presence, they go, it's time to be foragers. We have forage out there, Vitellogenin levels drop. The presence of brood, Vitellogenin levels drop. Because
they change, they're not just surviving and keeping the queen warm. They have jobs to do.
And they're going, it's springtime.
Yeah.
We don't need to be winter bees anymore. It's spring. But guess what? It's not spring. You've just tricked them into thinking it's spring by stimulating all of this.
And also, they don't need to be winter bees anymore because they think they have a crop of new bees coming in, replacing them.
That they might be jacked up bees because the temperatures aren't warm enough because they don't have enough bees to create that temperature. So it's like the dumb leading the dumb, the blind leading the blind. It's just like a negative spiral. And we talk all the time. I feel like I keep saying we say all the time, but we all the time.
We do
try to be as natural as possible.
Yeah, if I was going to say that.
When you're between two choices, we always go with the more natural choice. And all the things we're talking about that you shouldn't be doing right now, they're all artificial management techniques.
Which is why learning bee biology is helpful.
All right, so you got lower brood temps affecting brood development. Okay, so I said, are you a commercial beekeeper before? A lot of people that are feeding early pollen are doing it because they're trying to create more brood because they want to split their hives early. They want to sell bees early.
Which is a risk because you don't even, again, for all of the factors, you don't even know if that's going to work.
To me, that means you're not getting as healthy of bees. You're not getting bees that you should be getting when you're buying those splits from somebody too early.
Money grabs, man.
When you're making decisions for the wrong reasons, Yeah, so like you might get all psyched, like, oh man, I'm going to get a really early nuke. This one beekeeper selling nukes way earlier than everybody else.
Well, also, did we talk about how they'll eat their brood for protein if they
don't? Yeah, I love reduce, reuse, recycle. Yeah, a whole lot like, of reusing.
So, yeah, so you could be rearing that, but they're actually not getting the second generation or whatever, the next generation that they need.
Or are you ready for this? The bees are going, this brood is developing poorly. Must be a problem with this queen. Must be the queen's fault. It's not. It's the environment.
It's the people's fault.
Yeah. It's our
goddamn humans.
Dumb humans. So yeah, I mean, just, I don't think, do I even need to say anything else? I mean, just bee biology is so wild. It's so cool when you just dive into it. But if you understood just how winter bee makeup is happening, you'd go, oh yeah, shouldn't be feeding pollen.
Yeah. It's just interrupting. Ooh. You're interrupting.
Yeah, that's just so, I love that.
Yeah, it's good.
I feel
good
like I info. Nailed that, right?
You nailed that. No like anxiety that. After this episode.
Well, as I'm reading these studies, I'm like, all right, cool. I'm good. And then we had a speaker, Montgomery County Beekeepers had a speaker last month. And it was interesting. She talked about at pollen feeding, and they showed pollen feeding in the spring significantly increased brood production, which we know, but it also leads to early swarming. Because you've artificially made these bees population. Think that there's more forage out there. So they go, ooh, we can do this. We can split ourselves. And we got all this brood right now. We can split ourselves. But in the end of that whole thing, honey production was unaffected. So you were creating all these extra bees and you're creating problems and you're creating more of swarm chances and you're creating less healthy bees for what? So you can sell an early split. Okay. Again, talked about that. Oh, because more bees is more honey production. Actual study showed unaffected. Honey production levels stayed almost identical.
Well, and I wonder, like, health of the bees. One way that you can tell if your bees have a good amount, a healthy amount of pollen, is if you look at the larva, at the larval stage.
Oh, yeah.
Look at the cells, and they should be swimming in that pool
royal of royal jelly. Baby.
And so if they're kind of like, and the larva should be bright white and plump and beautiful and just glistening. And if it's not, that's how you know you don't have enough pollen. And that would be a situation where maybe you want to supplement or
take a frame of bee bread from somebody that looks loaded.
Yeah.
And bring it over.
Depending upon how many hives you have. But that's a good way to.
And that's always like a pattern recognition thing. You have different hives. You know, if you're beekeeping with one hive, it's tough. But, you know, a situation where you're like, huh, I dug a little deeper. I'm looking a little deeper than just making sure there's eggs and I'm seeing how much royal jelly they're swimming in.
Yeah.
And noticing this hive looks different. These look different than hive B. Bing, bing, bing.
That's also, you can really elevate your beekeeping when you're not just looking for the presence of eggs and the presence of honey or whatever you're looking for, like looking for the health of the hive. And that's one thing that you can evaluate.
Yeah. Go deeper. Yeah.
And if you're like, I don't know, keep looking and you'll see. Like, you could, like, again, comparison. Yeah.
So there was a year that Kara and I fed. We made these, like, open pollen
feeders
yeah. with PVC, and we hung them from trees, like, you know, 100 yards away from the hives. And the reason we did it was because February was crazy warm and all these trees started blooming way early. I remember, like, even in DC, you know, 150 200 miles
from us, cherry blossom year,
cherry blossom festival that they have every year, the trees all bloomed, and then this big freeze happened. We had these ice storms, killed every bud on all these early blooming maples, witch hazel, maple. What are the early ones? But it, either way, it killed dogwoods.
Yeah,
it, which I guess is cherry family, whatever. But it killed all these buds, and these bees were stimulated naturally, and then all of a sudden had this dormancy period, and we went, oh shit, okay, let's throw some pollen out. Let's try to keep them going. And help them out, because naturally they already had this switch. And then, you know, we live in this very unpredictable climate. So that was a time that it made sense.
Yeah.
Since then, One time I put pollen out, they never even touched it.
But they were all over it that year.
Exactly, because they really needed it.
Yeah,
and it was interesting. We were reacting. And we, you know, it's funny. We did that.
Responding.
We did that not being so... That's like hindsight, where I went, oh, that's why that happened. That made sense.
I know. When you said that right now, I'm like, oh, like, wow, that was good.
We were smarter than we thought.
Look how smart we are.
So swarm control. This is like, I mean, it's like kind of the downfall of being a good beekeeper, is that you're going to have to split your hives. These hives are coming out of winter. If they're healthy,
or the upside.
They naturally want to split. And I'm saying downside because not everybody has the equipment. Not everybody has the time.
Also, what a pain in the ass checking. It's like to be in there once a week or doing the thing. It's like very intense.
Yeah. So, I mean, can you even do it? Can you even really say I'm going to control swarming? And my overall answer is no.
Well, what does control mean? Like not?
Good job. Can you stop swarming?
No, you can't stop swarming.
No, there's millions of years of biology and evolution in bees that have led them to this is how they procreate on a different level.
Yeah, it's how they reproduce. You're not going to stop a being from reproducing. That's what everything on this planet, plants, insects, humans, animals, they want to reproduce.
You want to stop them from reproducing? Here's a great way. Have an unhealthy hive. That's how you're going to stop them.
I don't think you want to. I mean,
no, people want to stop it.
Okay, well, that's a human thing. Like, if you want to stop swarming, that's because you don't, for whatever human reason, you want to stop swarming. But as a beekeeper that's looking out for the bees and like bee forward, I don't know if bee forward is the word, but like you don't want to stop swarming.
No, and when I've looked back at hives, so out of our 50-ish hives last year, two of them didn't swarm. Didn't give us swarm cells, show that they were going to swarm. How we split is we wait for them to tell us that they want to split. We wait till we see swarm cells and then we react to it. We don't do walk away preemptive splits. Just not how we roll.
Also, those, if I'm thinking of the two that are right, those were such beasts.
Well, you're thinking of hives that I created queens from early, where I took some brood and eggs and had them create queens in a queen castle. And then they didn't split. But I did take, that wasn't a natural thing because I was taking some of their population. And yo, they were crazy boomtown.
Well, that's all. And they were like hard to manage, kind of. I would be like, yeah, okay, time for this.
Here
hive.
We go. This hive is so crowded.
Oh, shit. Like, that's also like, if you don't want to split your hive, you're going to have a beast to handle.
Yeah. And it feels good when you split a hive. You come back a month later, there's a new queen. You're like, they're good. I can just let them be.
It is a real problem, though, if you are, like you said, the reason people don't want to split is because they're having too many hives. What do you do in that situation? You really need to find somebody to take your bees or something.
Yeah, and there's people that tell me, no, I let them swarm. It's natural. I let them swarm. It's like, all right, I get it. However, I view that as a bad beekeeper because those bees, again, bees...
They're not surviving.
Bees aren't natural to our environment here in the United States, at least. They're a non-native species. They are not an invasive species. I'll fight that any day of the week. But they are not a native. There's no arguing that. And when you're allowing your human-managed beehives to split, to swarm on themselves, those bees might end up in somebody's house. They might end up in somebody's, you know, shed. They might end up wherever, and well, like that's not good.
Well, that's not, kind of the definition of invasive is having a negative impact on the environment.
But so, it's not. Well, I guess we're not humans being negatively impacted.
Well, also there's disease. I mean, disease. So it kind of depends on. You can have invasive bees if you aren't managing them properly.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Argue with me on that one. Let's go.
So, you know, people go like, no, just give them space, you know, and we've tried this. Trust us. We've tried this space. Here's the deal. You can give them space, but that space means, A, you need to have built out frames.
Yeah, you have to have the equipment for
that. A box with non, you know, comb, built comb frames is not space.
Nope, not space, because they can't do anything with it.
Yeah, and they may build that area, but until they build it, they do not view that as space. It's like living in a house and putting a second floor on, and the second floor is framed. Doesn't mean you've got four extra bedrooms. You right. just have open framed house. Until that roof is on, there's the drywall's up, and there's some beds up there, it ain't space. Right?
We know that. We live in this
yeah,
house.
I'm looking around going, you have a pretty small house.
Oh, boy.
So, yes, you can add boxes, but here's what happens. You're opening up for pests. You're opening up wax moths. You're opening up areas that small hive beetles can hide. Also, that queen pheromone needs to be able to be spread entirely through that hive. You're just throwing on a bunch of space. That queen pheromone might not be strong enough to completely spread, which is going to cause problems with your hive. So the whole just add space thing, yes
it's just
and no.
Not that simple. Nothing with beekeeping is simple.
Yeah. Now I will say, if you want them to swarm, right? So you want them to create swarm cells so you can do your splits. And we have done this in years ago when we went, hey, you know, we want to ramp up. So I would like to get some splits going. I purposely didn't add an extra super. I waited a week or two. I let them be a little bit more crowded.
You got to be vigilant though.
But I knew I had to be checking, and I'll get into it in a second, but you know, every 7 days without missing a beat.
Yeah, you can't. You got to be on it.
And now we're at the point where I can look at a hive and I can go, I have a feeling they're going to swarm soon. Like by how they're acting and how much space they have. So although I don't recommend it because, you know, it's kind of going a little bit natural, if you want to force some swarming, you want to force that natural split to start on its own, you can not give them some space. That will definitely work. But just giving them more space is not going to mean they're not going to swarm. You'll delay the swarm a little bit, yes, but it's still going to happen.
I've never...
And adding more space is more places that you got to check to see if there's cells, you know, so...
I just... I've never met a beekeeper that's said I didn't make my bees swarm. Like what?
That's why I don't think it's really possible. So there is the Demery method. We talked about it on a previous episode. I'm a hater. It's a super unnatural way of beekeeping and it's super labor intensive, but that is a way that you can get them to not swarm. You're like tricking them. And you know, it's all configuration based.
That's also very intense, right? Super labor intensive. You're in there all the time. Yeah.
Yeah, big time. But that is a way. Although I feel like you're using extra equipment. Certainly taking up a lot more of your time, a lot more physicality. You're moving boxes around.
Well, it's interesting. I'm wondering if people that don't want swarms don't want to be in their hives more. Like, I know I've talked to so many beekeepers that they just don't really want to beekeep. They don't yeah. want to go in. They don't want to make those decisions. They don't want to have to, like, manipulate and, like, kill the queen or do whatever. So I'm wondering if the people that are trying to do this also kind of just don't, they don't really want to be beekeepers. They kind of just, like... You know what I mean? I don't know. I'm just curious about that.
Yeah, but it's like subconsciously... You know,
yeah,
or they don't want to do what it takes to be a successful beekeeper, in our opinion,
on our definition of it's just interesting. Like people are like, I don't really want to go in. And I'm like, yeah, but you're gonna like.
We talked a lot about this a few episodes ago. I think the title of the episode is Beekeeping with a Purpose. It's why do you want to keep bees, and you know, starting off with a very honest why I want to keep bees is going to allow you. You know, what is that purpose? It's going to allow you to make some better decisions. It's being honest with yourself about that. So maybe that's something people aren't being totally honest with themselves. And they're not willing to do exactly what they need to do to own this livestock we talk about.
Well, and so many people I've talked to, I'm talking about, like, I think this one guy I was talking to this one time, and he was like, I don't know if I have a queen, but I don't really want to go in. And my wife was saying, like, it looks like I got a queen. I'm like, that's not how you determine that.
I remember you being so annoyed when you got home from talking to that person.
And I was just like, he was aware that he didn't want to go in the hive, but he wasn't aware that, and like, even I've seen this so many times, are like, well, I don't want to disturb them. And I'm like, but that's not
you're putting them in human made boxes.
Right.
You can't pick and choose in those circumstances.
You're killing your hive because you won't go in. So
it's like, yeah, you have cattle and you're like, well, they don't have any feed because they ate all of the grass that we had them penned in on. Well, you know, they'll figure it out, I guess. I don't want to intervene.
Yeah. So it's like, I don't know.
So anyway, I'm not going to get, we've never done demery ourselves. I've researched it. I've certainly heard. It
makes my head spin just hearing the word.
Yeah. I don't like it at all. There's some people that do it that I really like as beekeepers and trust as beekeepers. And there's some people that do it that I absolutely despise as human beings. So, you know, do your thing, but do it with the right purpose. So we talked split. Our most popular episode by far, our most listened to episode is titled How We Split. And it's number one. It's been number one since like a month after we put it out there.
Oh, wow.
Continues to be number one every single week. It's the most listened to episode. And really? In the springtime, it gets a huge bump. I did a full, it's snowing out right now.
Oh my God, it's snowing out. It's
snowing out. It was 67 degrees yesterday.
Ew.
What perfect timing.
Why you don't put pollen in your beehives? Holy crap. And it's like blowing like sideways.
Yeah. 20 mile an hour winds and it's snowing.
The chickens are probably like, what? Yeah.
So yeah, whatever. So there, I was saying there's like a full, I go like pretty nitty gritty about how we do splits in a YouTube video. I think it might be like 45 minutes and I go,
Are you wearing a shirt or did you keep your shirt on or did you take it off?
What does that mean?
You know, that guy that doesn't wear a shirt in the YouTube videos.
Yeah. No, I think I have a shirt on.
Okay.
I think I have a veil on.
Okay.
We always make fun of these social media quote unquote beekeepers that, you know, capture swarms without any equipment.
Their locks are flowing.
Yeah. And there's a beekeeper I follow, a female beekeeper that I follow that I think kicks ass. She rules.
Do you want to give her a name?
No, because okay. I don't know it off the top of my head.
Oh, okay.
But I just saw a post that she made. It was like, people get so mad at me for not wearing equipment. Like, I'm a trained professional. I know what I'm doing. And I just wanted to reply to her like, well, yeah, your hair's pulled back. Like the people I can't stand are doing it with like hair down in their face.
But
like,
it's done also.
Oh yeah. It's straight out of the salon. And I'm like, and your suit's dirty. So you're a real beekeeper versus these ones I see that look like their suit has been, you know.
Does she have straight hair? Cause I'm just thinking even my hair pulled back is like, they get in there. They get stuck.
You can go back and listen to our full episode on splits. You can check out the YouTube video, Mind Your Hives Beekeeping on YouTube. We don't do a ton there. We lost equipment back when we lost our house in Hurricane Ida, another episode. It's called Hurricane Ida FU. So I haven't done a ton of video stuff since then, but we put that out, I think last year. And I mean, I nitty gritty, I literally am like, this is how I stack boxes as I'm checking for swarm cells.
Yeah,
like,
it's good.
I get down to it.
Because the way we check, because we have so many hives, it is very efficient.
Yeah. I mean, we're flipping and looking on the underside of boxes. Like it takes me 4 minutes per hive when I'm doing just swarm cell checking.
Even the stacking of hives. Yeah. That would be a good one to look at.
One thing people are like, well, I don't want to split because I'm not going to get a honey harvest. I'll tell you right now, again, we're in Pennsylvania. And we keep our bees in areas that they have ample resources. Our colonies that we split, we take the queen and we move her, just like if they were swarming, they would leave with the laying queen. So we take that laying queen and move her into a nuc, and then we build up that hive. We always get a spring harvest, and then we get a summer/fall. We don't always get a fall harvest. I kind of lump summer and fall together in a way. There's been years we get both, but we get a spring harvest from the hives that we split. It gives them a brood break. It honestly, and we talk about it in that episode, it makes them go, hey, we don't need as many nurse bees because we get a little bit of a brood break, and there's more foragers happening when the super flow is going on in the spring. So even though they're not making bees for a few weeks, they're boomtown foraging. So we get a really nice honey harvest in the spring. The hive that we split from them, you know, so we basically take a nuc from them, that hive, we get a summer and fall/fall harvest from, unless they need to build out
frames.
When they're building out frames, we're never going to expect any type of harvest.
So just to build off what you said, when we split and then we have the hive that's waiting for the queen to be there, we oftentimes, depending on the situation, add a box because they'll build out at that time because, like you said, they don't have anything to do. So they're bringing in honey, they're building wax, they're building frames, and that can be like a really good, give them a job.
Yeah, give them a job. And I mean, now we're fortunate where we have so many built out frames and we're, you know, we have some hives that are made for building out frames that we're purposely having be frame factories for us, and we are prepared for it. So like going into the season, I know how many of our hives are going to be, you know, quote unquote honey hives, and how many are going to be frame builders and, you know, whatever. Planning, do a little bit of planning. And yeah, just, you know, real quick on how we make those splits. We take that queen, we move her, we make sure that there's no queen cells on any of the frames that we take and create that nuke with. And then know your bee math. You know, at day, when a queen cell at day 8-ish is going to be capped and day 16 is going to emerge a virgin queen. So we know, and typically as soon as those cells, that queen, those queen cells, swarm cells are capped, they are swarming. The next nice morning, they're swarming. So if we go in, I find open queen cells, open swarm cells. I know that it's before day 8. We take that queen, we move her. And I know as long as I come back within the next 7 days, I can cut out the remaining swarm cells.
And you have to check every cell.
Yeah.
Every cell. You can't just flip boxes because you will miss some and you will have
secondary swarms.
And you will just have virgins out the wazoo.
And I think the secondary swarms is the biggest death sentence when you're allowing your bees to swarm. Now, yes, Tom Seeley says 75% of swarms will not survive. So, you know, you're letting your bees swarm naturally and just letting them go. 75% of those swarms, they're dead. Dunzo.
If you don't catch them, which catching them is,
that's
like
what I'm saying, that go into the wild.
Yeah.
And yes, catching swarms is just annoying. Sometimes it's so easy, but most of the time, not cool.
It's climatry.
But on top of that is you're going to have secondary and tertiary and beyond swarming, and then
it's depleting your hive.
Yeah. Next thing you know, you don't have bees. You have 25% of your bees left and you're not getting anything out of that. So why do you keep bees? You keep bees so you have a bunch killed and maybe create havoc for somebody's house, or, you know, like, come on, what, beekeeping with a purpose. Last thing I want to say before we get into herb corner is, mark your queens.
Yes. We found a dead queen the other day, and yeah, she was bright pink, and we knew, we saw her and we knew she was dead and we knew what year she was.
Sad, womp womp.
And then we also saw a queen that was a yellow queen, right? And yeah, we were like,
oh shit.
Yeah, she's kind of older.
Mark your queens. I don't, off the top of my head, I don't know the colors, but there's like 5 or 6 colors that determine it. Yeah, determine the year. Last year was red. I love the red because it's like this bright pinkish red, the marker we had. And so easy to find. But every year it's a different color. We use a little like plastic kind of device that has like a foam plunger built into it that allows us to catch that queen, put her in there, and then mark her. It's so easy, people. It's really easy. This might be the most important skill that, like, where important meets easy. That is this, marking your queen. And it's Amazon, wherever, go to your bee store. Queen marking paint pen. So easy. You can practice on drones if you want. I mean, I'm at the point now, I just grab the queen, I put her in the little thing, done. But in the beginning, I would like sit there and like have her like walk into
thing.
Only piece of advice is when you're catching the actual queen, do it close, very, very close to the hive, because if she does fly away, she'll fly right back. If you take that frame that the queen's on, you move her to the other side of your apiary, you move her somewhere else because you're trying to get away from the bees, and she flies away, she might return, but that's where I start to worry.
She should know where it's at because she's left the hive, but is she going to make the trip back is the question.
Yes.
Also, I've lost a queen, and she's just kind of, I found her, I just sit there, I sit, and I wait, and she's circling around, and then you can kind of follow her. Anytime, like, I remember the first queen, I have to take my gloves off to to Mark Queens.
Yeah.
Like, I cannot do it with gloves on.
Don't try to do that.
I've also, Greg has sat near me. I'm like, you have to leave. I can't have, you have to be away from me. I have to do this on my own. And I literally, like, I'm better now because I've done it, but I don't know, first queen I marked this year, I might be the same. I'm nervous. My heart is pounding. My hands are shaking a little bit. I'm like, you know, talking to the bees. I'm like, all right, we're just going to, you know, it's fine. You have to be very careful in your management. But you can do, like, you can do this.
Let's I mark her. I'm like, look at this work of art. This is perfect marking.
The first queen I ever marked, she was white and the pen bled all over her. And I'm like, I did it. And Craig's like, the whole bee is white. Like, what did you do? Yeah, I'm like, listen, I did it and I am proud of myself. So I found the colors. So,
is it a blue year?
It depends. It's a green year. Depends on the end number.
Right.
So
we're a four this year.
Yeah. 4 and 9 is green. 2 and 7 is yellow. 3 and 8 is red. And 5 and 0 is blue. Oh, and, I lost it. And white is 1 and 6. So we are a green year. So go get your green pens. And then, you know, you have so much information in your hive about that. And if we go back and we see a yellow queen or a white queen, like, they are going to supersede. Yeah. I think we should do an episode on how to find a queen. Cause you taught me that and it's so good. It helps you find her.
Yeah.
And then it also helps you know if they supersede.
If you come back and there's a queen
and she's not marked and you're like, oh, this is a new queen.
Yeah, it makes you understand what's happening in that hive.
Yeah, it gives you a lot of information.
Big time. Big time. But honestly, the biggest advantage is it's so easy to find and you're not going to make a dumb mistake of not realizing a queen is on a frame and something happens, or moving a frame to a different hive, the queen. Yeah,
I've moved a queen to another hive and then made a queenless hive. There is an Instagram post on Mind Your Hives where Greg is holding up our pen. So, like, if you're like, what's a good brand? Like, the brand we use is on Instagram.
Yeah. Cool. That was it for my, that's everything for me. So Herb Corner.
Yeah, Herb Corner. So mushrooms and bees.
I guess I could talk a little bit first before you dive into like mushroom specific.
Yeah, I think because we picked this because of mushrooms
and bees. Yeah, so shout out Instagram follower Shutterblind that hit us up and was like, I mentioned in the last episode, we were going to talk about it, but asked us if we know about Paul Stamets. Paul Stamets is a leading mycologist in the United States. Stamets, S-T-A-M-E-T-S. Paul Stamets rules. He's awesome. He really is the reason I got into just like mushrooms, period. Medicinal / psychedelic. I love mushrooms. When people are like, I don't eat them because I don't like how they feel in your mouth, they're like, you don't understand how good they are for you. Do it. And also, come on, stop it. You're a child. but Paul Stamets, a big thing he has is bees, the positive effects of this mycelium for mushrooms and on bee health. He's done a ton of studies on it. And you should read about him. I'm not going to just repeat his studies. He's got so much out there. Host Defense, is that his company?
Yeah, I think Host Defense sounds familiar.
Yeah, I think it's called Host Defense. But he has his own mushroom company that you can buy plugs. They're all sold out all the time because he's so popular. I actually got plugs most recently from North Spore. I think it's North Spore. You can inoculate logs to grow your own mushrooms. So I bought all these plugs that are these, you know, inoculated little pieces of wood. You drill a hole, you tap it in. Guess what you cover that hole with?
Beeswax.
Bingo, beeswax. And then, you know, 3, 6, 9 months later, boom, you've got like an inoculated log and you're going to start getting flushes. It's so rad.
You need to make sure that you know which mushroom's going in which wood because it's not just universal.
Yeah, North Spore is really great about it. They send you like a little sheet that has all different types of tree and wood on it and tells you which mushroom can grow in that medium, blah, blah, blah. So awesome. But
so know your mushroom, know your tree, ones.
So Paul Stamets, it's like these polypore mushrooms growing. Bears, you know, scratch at trees. These polypore mushrooms grow from the trees. And he noticed that these honeybees were foraging on these polypores. And then he started doing studies and showed that they so very positively affect the health of the bees. And it was deformed wing virus and nosema And just he saw
and
the
mite resistance,
the positive,
right?
The positive effects.
Okay.
But the mite, the diseases that these
That's
mites
what
are
I
causing.
Meant. Yes.
So it's not, I don't think, eliminating the mites
but
in
like
any
immune.
Way. But it's building up the immunity of these bees, helping their gut health. So you can take an ounce of reishi, specifically the mushroom reishi, R-E-I-S-H-I, which is that what you're going to talk
yeah,
about?
It is. Yeah,
reishi is like
that
the
that
most medicinal
it.
of the mushrooms. But an ounce of reishi extract, which I think is like 20-ish bucks, and 1 ounce into a gallon of syrup, and that's how people will feed these mushrooms to their bees. We've never done that. We do use Hive Alive, which is a seaweed extract with some nutrients in it, and we'll put that in feed. But we only feed our hives to what I call top them off going into winter. I don't do any spring feeding.
Splits. Maybe.
It's pretty rare.
They build and stuff.
Most of our splits, again, because we're like splitting when they're telling us they're ready, that they're going to swarm, it means that there's a flow happening and they have enough nectar to gather themselves, so there's no point in even giving them food. However, if they need to build, did you just say that?
I said building.
Yeah. So if they need to build, then throw a gallon of syrup or a couple mason jars on there, so you guarantee they're good on those rainy days when they're stuck in their hive. But I'd love to hear from y'all out there, like are people using mushroom extracts? Are you feeding bees with some mushrooms? Are you seeing positive effects? Is it worth that, like, $20 a hive type thing that you'd have to do?
Yeah. You also need to be careful with all herbs, like who's making this mushroom extract, because mushroom extracts are a little bit more complicated to make. So you want to make sure that you're getting like a high quality product.
Yeah. And I know I was on a list. I went on it in like 2018. Paul Stamets was crowdfunding some type of device that was like an inoculated something that was a feeder that then people could put out and it would collect rain that would, put this mushroom, whatever, into the little feeder, to try to native pollinators to get to, experience these natural mushrooms that unfortunately grow in these old growth forests that aren't growing the way they should be in all these not old, new growth forests that are everywhere, or non-forests that aren't anywhere. So super interesting, but go check out Paul Stamets. I highly recommend it. Highly recommend microdosing and love me some mushrooms.
Also another book that was recommended to us that Greg just bought me for my birthday, but we haven't gotten into it. I've just cracked it open, but Christopher Hobbs is a longtime herbalist and he has a book called Medicinal Mushrooms, The Essential Mushroom Guide. So that could be another, if you're interested in mushrooms and their, herbal properties, that's something else you can check out. So reishi is grows in northern temperate regions of Asia, North America, and Europe, so it's widespread, and we're looking at the red reishi. So there's also a black reishi, which the medicinal properties are like but the red reishi is really what we're looking at for like super medicinal purposes. It's a super medicine. And the energetics, which we've been talking about, are warm and neutral, but reishi is pretty universal, which means basically anybody can take reishi and it can help balance them out. It's really good, first and foremost, for the immune system. So a lot of situations and before I say anything, reishi and mushrooms are a long-term herb. So if you have a panic attack or you have like a digestive issue and you want to drink a cup of peppermint tea, that's short-term acute acting in that moment. But reishi, if you want to build your immune system and you get sick, you don't want to just start taking reishi. That's like
I mean, you might want to start taking reishi, but don't expect results immediately.
Exactly. There you go. So it's good.
We were talking to an herbalist that just said to us, she was like, I have a crock pot of reishi tea going at all times year round.
And that's because she has chronic Lyme or persistent Lyme that she has different flare ups. So it's good for people that have had Lyme to boost the immune system to help support that. HIV AIDS, people with that, hepatitis.
So these syndromes, diseases, whatever you want to call it, that are hugely affecting your immune system.
Right. Cancer. Tells
you that reishi is going to support your immune, like, you know, the worst of the worst, like you need it. You need that help. So imagine what it can do to you if
you don't,
you're not dealing with the worst of the worst. You're just, you know, souping up.
And it's also a really good nerving, which means it helps. It's an anxiolytic. It helps the nervous system.
You and your words.
Well, I want to
tell anxiolytic. I like it.
I know. I want to teach people some words. So
I think I'm an anxiolytic.
It's calming. It's an adaptogen. Adaptogen are herbs that like help restore the nervous system. Again, on a long-term basis, like a lot of people take ashwagandha. Ashwagandha is a adaptogen, and it helps like people that are anxious and people that have like stress induced symptoms, maybe like headaches or stress induced GI problems, or, you know, just like panic attacks. So like I had said before, mushrooms need to be like, the cell walls of mushrooms are really tough and hard to break down. So if you make dinner and at the last minute you throw some mushrooms into the pan and just kind of let them soften, you're probably not getting the medicinal effect of the mushrooms. You really want to cook these mushrooms down, break down the cell wall, because it won't be broken down in our digestive system. And then we'll just poop it out. So that's why you want them, the medicine extracted in certain ways. So what we have is we have bought mushroom powders. They have a lot of them from Mushroom Harvest. And Mushroom Harvest extracts the medicine, and then they send you this powder, and it's bioavailable immediately. So what I've been doing lately is every morning I make like a little drink. Side note, it's just like Dandy Blend, which is really amazing and good for digestive tract, cacao, which is really good for your brain. But I started putting reishi powder in it from this Mushroom Harvest that's immediately bioavailable. And I didn't even remember that reishi was good for the nervous system, but I'm in school and I am so relaxed. I am just like floating on a cloud. Everything's great.
Sounds great, man.
Yeah. And I'm like, I think it's the reishi. And then I looked it up and it is the reishi.
What are you bioavailable, you're saying?
Yeah. So your body can use it right away.
Yeah. So we were asking our herbalist, the other day on a video call, if what we're using is bioavailable, and they list it, the company she just mentioned, Kara mentioned Mushroom Harvest, but they list it as activated reishi mushroom mycelium. So that activated is their way of saying bioavailable. And yeah. It's the preparation that they use before powdering this.
Yes. So you have to break down the cell walls.
Yeah. So it might not say bioavailable, but it says activated, which is giving you that hint. But not every powder is going to be that. Powder, exactly. You might have to take that powder and you might have to put it in a crock pot
and let it simmer for hours.
Yeah.
Like there's a lot of mushroom coffees. Just because the mushroom is in whatever doesn't mean that your body can actually use it.
Interesting.
Yeah. It also helps with like physical performance. So like flexibility, being able to even just like have endurance, people with fibromyalgia. Let's see what else. Oh, it has like good effects on the heart, lowering cholesterol, lowering blood pressure. And I just learned about this the other day. It inhibits clumping of platelets. So when your platelets clump together, there's not the whole cell surface, the surface of the cell. So like oxygen exchange and everything that it's supposed to do, because it's being clumped together. So if they unclump, then the whole surface of the cell can do its job. And then you're like maximizing each cell to do work.
Kind of like when you try to do an oxalic acid vaporization and yes. It's too cold out and the bees are clustered together too much, they're not going to be able to get the effects of it.
Exactly. Because
they're too clustered. You want them to be a little broken up.
Which is like, what, 56 degrees or something? Like over something like that?
Yeah, but in the hive is the whole thing.
And then it reduces triglycerides, which is like the fat in the blood, which can lead to like high cholesterol, or not lead to high cholesterol, but can lead to like fatty deposits in the arteries. So like hardening arteries, narrowing arteries, insulin resistance, so blood sugar. It has like low, moderate levels of liver repair with alcohol, with damage by excess alcohol, or hepatitis. What else? It's anti-inflammatory. It helps with asthma.
Why hear just conventional doctors going, make sure you take, you're drinking reishi tea, you know, like I'm hearing all this and I'm just thinking to myself, like, it's so ridiculous that I have to go to an herbalist that's going to tell me these things when this is such a proactive approach to helping your immune system and your health. But there's no proactive in our
healthcare system. Everybody's bought.
So frustrating.
It's pharmaceuticals. And the thing about, like, so I'm drinking this reishi every day and you have to hide it probably.
It tastes like mushrooms if you need to. The blend we talked about like this bitter, it's made with dandelions. It's this bitter. I love the taste of it, but it totally masks.
Well, also if you want to put it in your coffee, you could probably put it in your coffee.
We make stock with all our veggie scraps and we put a few scoops of the mushroom powder in the stock. The stock is simmering. It's extracting all these nutrients that are left over from these scraps. And then we're using that stock to cook our pasta, to cook our rice, to make soup. And we're getting all these awesome, you know, these mushroom whatever's from that.
So if it's not bioavailable, you really should simmer it for like 2 to 4 hours at like 120, 130 degrees.
So maybe you bought reishi at a farmer's market that the whatever has reishi. It's probably going to be dried when you get it, but if not, you know, you want to finely chop that, or you want to, even if you can, you know, coffee grind it into a more of a powder.
But that's only if it's going to be dried. Yeah.
Yeah. And then, like you just said, 2-4 hours at a low simmer.
Yeah. But like, so I said that the effects are long-term, but like, I really am noticing the anxiolytic anti-anxiety effects like right away. I think check it out.
And check out carajoskincare.com for a bunch of really amazing herbal-infused skincare products.
Absolutely.
If you listen this far.
You're a rock star, man.
We really appreciate it. Again, shout out to all the folks that are hitting us up, asking questions, giving feedback. Y'all rule.
Yeah, thanks for letting us do this. We have fun doing this, so thanks for supporting us and letting us keep doing this.
Peace. We outta here. No,